Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Jerry, welcome back to the show. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine. Always great to be with you. Is Kathy there, too?
Here I am, Jer.
Hey, Kathy. How are you?
I'm well. I'm very interested in a bunch of these topics that we're going to talk about today, Jerry. And I always appreciate hearing your perspective, as do all of our listeners. So let's start with this. Big crowd events. You know, John and I are experiencing emotional desperation brought on by lack of baseball. Mm-hmm. And so that's, of course, the number one thing on my mind. But, you know, my daughter's graduating from high school on Saturday. Usually she'd be graduating in a stadium filled with, you know, 1,000 people. And instead, we're going to be in a absolutely empty stadium with nine other families at a time. And it's going to take 6 hours for the graduating class to graduate because there's going to be nobody there. So how do we think about this, Jer? What are the considerations and what's on your mind?
Well, I think you've laid out one of the considerations quite well already. There is a social and a cultural cost to not having these gatherings. So I've written about the economic cost, and the economic cost is pretty minimal. Baseball's great, but you know, the U.S. economy doesn't run on baseball, and it doesn't even run on football, right? These big crowd events hold us together. They're a kind of a civic glue. In the case of church, they're a spiritual glue. In the case of recovery programs, they can be really important to our quality of life. I mean, even whether we continue to live. But in terms of economics, they don't amount to much because people are always saying, well, how can we ever come back from this until we have a vaccine and there'll always be a fear? And how can they ever open everything back up? Well, I think probably they'll open up big crowd events last. And, you know, we don't have to wreck the economy if we do that. We might, you know, might be weird to watch baseball on, you know, on TV instead of being at the ballpark. But in terms of keeping our economy going and growing, those things don't really pack a big economic punch.
Hmm. So all the concerts, all that stuff, Jerry, you're saying that'll be the last thing to come into focus.
I think that it is. That's the kind of thing that I think policymakers would be most hesitant about. In other words, is the president is saying, "Hey, Fauci, you know, hey, Dr. Birx, what can we open up?" I think they're going to say big crowds last, and probably also things like nail salons, because you're there for a long time when you get your mani-pedi. I haven't had one. I don't know, but I think you're there for a long time and you're close together. So those kinds of things, they're not really big economically. Now, I've got people who work in those jobs, and it's really terrible that they've been put out of work, and we ought to make them whole. It's not their fault. But the kind of thing that is naturally a kind of dangerous in terms of big crowds and disease transmission generally don't tend to be the things that really drive the U.S. economy. Manufacturing is like a seventh of our economy. Finance is like another seventh of our economy. Professional services, right? So these things right there between those three were at more, you know, really half of our economy. These things like concerts, sporting events, parks, right, recreation, you add all of those up, all of those things, and they're about 1% of our economy. If they went away entirely, it would be a 1% loss. And they haven't gone away entirely. They just will probably have more social distancing.
Wow.
So, Jerry, but the weird thing is, though, right, emotionally, people need these somehow, that they enrich our lives to the point of, you know, wanting us to drive us to places like that. They give us great pleasure. There's information. There's a lot of joy there.
And there's a whole sector of the marketplace that surrounds them, right? Bars, restaurants, that sort of thing.
That's right. Bars and restaurants, you add them together and maybe you're at another 0.5% or 1% of the economy. So all of that, it doesn't really add up to much. These aren't big value added businesses. Again, they have a certain social cohesion. I'm not against them. I'm not trying to diminish them. I grew up in that. But when I was a little boy, I was basically raised by my grandparents, the Boyer Bar and Grill. We lived upstairs from the bar and grill. So I understand that these watering holes are socially very important, but the economies don't rise and fall with them.
Hmm. I see. Go ahead, Kat.
Well, I'm just asking what economies do rise and fall on. You mentioned manufacturing.
Yeah. Yeah, manufacturing's a biggie, and finance is a biggie. New York, the United States is really the financial capital of the world. Information technology is quite big as well. These are the big value-added items. Retail is about 3%, but retail hasn't gone away entirely. A lot of it's just gone online or with delivery. So we don't have zero retail now. I think we had like a 16% decline in retail when the shutdown was at its worst. That means that, most retail stayed even when we stopped shopping. Some of it got accelerated. I guess here's my point is the nature of the economy is such that we can take reasonable precautions and still have a reasonably strong economy while we're working through this. We don't have these stark trade-offs between shut everything down, kill the economy, or start up the economy and kill a bunch of vulnerable people in their 80s with diabetes. That's not the choice. We can weigh things and trade them off against one another and optimize the opening up process.
All right. So then next week, I saw in the paper today that Rich Fitzgerald said he doesn't have any intel about this. Our county executive has no intel from the Wolf administration about when they may open to the green, to the, the full level of openness. But he's saying he thinks it may be in a couple of weeks. So if that's the case, in a couple of weeks that everything would open, what's the primary thing? I mean, that drives the economy. It's important for us all to have a paycheck and to, make sure our kids are fed and our mortgages are paid.
Yeah, and I'm having a little trouble understanding Rich Fitzgerald, who I know and I like, but, we have a really flat curve in Allegheny County. You don't have to be a COVID denialist to say, hey, wait a minute, why are we so slow to open up here? We have very little transmission. We're getting very few new cases. So maybe we're a little bit too much on the caution side about the disease and less on the caution side about our social health and our economy. So that having been said, yeah, probably things schools are important, right? Because schools, let's say primary schools instead of college, they are to some degree daycare centers. So it's hard for parents to be productive if they've got primary school kids at home. So I get the argument for opening up schools. That has an economic impact, not because primary schools in themselves are a big economic driver. I mean, if they do their job, then 20 years from now, they'll be drivers because people know how to read and cipher, because they went to primary school. So that's a long-term investment. But in the short run, basically the economic effect is that mom and dad can focus on working from home rather than focus on, taking care of the little one. So I think opening up of schools makes sense. But, we have a lot of things around here, a lot of things like down at the point where there's a lot of primary colors and they're playing classic or oldies music and there's blaring music and there's frying a lot of things. And people are crowded together, whatever, the regatta, the arts festival and whatever. Those things are wonderful. I like to go to those things. But our economy will not collapse if we don't do some of those loudspeaker, big crowd at the point of events. It's a social cost. It's really not a big macroeconomic cost.
Okay. Jerry Boyer is our guest, editor of Town Hall Finance. Jerry, tell us then about how, the world of finance, it's a world that you understand well. Talk about how that's been impacted as far as the day-to-day work of people who are in that career path. So are people working at home? How are people impacted now?
Yeah, people who work in finance have a lot more ability to work from home. Most of them have already, already have some kind of work from home situation. So there's a real class divide here. If you're a high school graduate or a high school dropout, the probability you can work from home is a whole lot less than if you've gone to graduate school. Professionals, and I think this is one reason why people who are knowledge workers and in the professions have been a little insensitive to the cost of the shutdown. They still get their Amazon deliveries. Blue Apron is still showing up for them, right? But somebody who's working in retail or cutting hair, they don't work from home. They can't cut hair from home. So I think there's been a little bit of a sense of the people who have disproportionate influence, expert class, knowledge workers, professionals, maybe aren't feeling the pain so much, so they're not really weighing this thing properly. I've noticed there's a real class divide about who wants to open up and who wants to say shut down. Because, if you're a lawyer and watching legal brief, you're writing legal briefs, you're writing code, if you're, in programming, you're a financial person, you might be, working at 95% of the capacity you had before. Personally, I'm very fortunate. I'm probably working at about 110 or 120% because I don't have so many meetings. taking up my time. I'm getting more done, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't count the cost. I shouldn't feel bear along one another for my Christian brothers and sisters and non-Christians who aren't able to work from home because they work with their hands. So we need to count that. And when we're deciding when to open up, we shouldn't just look at things from the standpoint of the kind of people who write journalistic articles that influence the debate about when to open up, but also feel from people who maybe aren't heard from as much.
Jerry Boyer is with us, editor of Town Hall Finance. But Jerry, before we move forward, we've got a slight detour.
Yeah, well, I want to go back to what you were saying about economic cost, because you also mentioned that there was a cultural cost to cutting things like baseball and concerts and gathering outside and, you know, regatta and art festival and all that sort of thing. So one of our listeners just weighed in, and she didn't, I don't think, fully appreciate the scope of what you were saying. But she said all the things that your guest is naming that, quote, don't impact our economy are things that are dear to the American way of life. How dare he, says Jackie. First of all, you've made one of our guests mad. Or one of our listeners mad.
One? You think it's just one?
Probably not.
I wish that I just made one of your... See, you can't talk about these things, right? I can say over and over again, there's a huge social cost. There's a terrible social cost. There's a really big social cost, but there's not an economic cost. And all they hear is, you hate regatta and baseball. You hate America. Right. You're attacking something I love. And it's the same on the other side. And that's why we can't make decisions as a culture, as a nation, because we can't even hear each other. I mean, you know, what's this Sunday in the church calendar? Pentecost.
Ascension.
Pentecost.
Yeah, right. So I think I have that right. I hope I do. Right. Pentecost Sunday. Sorry. It's about a world where nobody could understand one another in the Tower of Babel. They would talk, but they couldn't hear. And when no one could understand one another, everything scatters. And then the Holy Spirit comes, and people who previously couldn't understand one another now can hear, even though someone's speaking in a different language. Boy, do we need Pentecost now, because we can't talk. We can't have a conversation about masks or about baseball or about anything without the how dare he. And it sounds like I'm mad. I'm not mad at Jackie. I'm mad at the spirit that doesn't allow us to hear each other. Let me tell you a story. Okay, let me tell you what I think about this shutdown. I'm at an emotional level. Now, some of what I'm about to tell you are lies, because you have to protect people. So I was taught by my pastoral mentor that you have to change things, okay? Not changing anything material. But there's a woman who's a friend of mine who was dealing with severe emotional problems, and she was in a church-related recovery group. And the church-related recovery group was shut down by the orders of the state and by the orders of the church. Yes. And this woman didn't go to recovery anymore. And you didn't get that face-to-face contact, and instead started going on Twitter and, you know, just kind of living on social media and being angry. And after about a couple of weeks, she took a gun and shot herself. She didn't kill herself, but she shot herself. And that's, man, that is a real cost to shut down. I am not ignoring the cost to shutdown, but I'm an economist, and people are terrified about we're going to destroy the economy and our economy is going to collapse. And I'm just trying to apply wisdom to people's irrational fear that COVID is destining us to a two-year depression. It isn't. All I'm trying to do is exercise biblical discernment. But when people are upset, they don't want to be talked out of being upset. So if they're too afraid of the COVID, then they don't want to be talked into even a partial open up. If they're too afraid of the shutdown, then they don't want to be talked to, because God weighs things, right? God's a weigher. So you have to have a scale, and there's one thing on one side of the scale and there's one thing on the other side of the scale. But instead, man tends to just go to one side of the scale and push. And I'm just trying to take a God's eye point of view and weigh things in terms of their impact rather than trigger people. But everyone's, I didn't choose that word intentionally, but everyone's got their finger on the trigger already all the time. And we have to get our fingers off the trigger and start to hear each other Pentecost fashion.
Got it.
Would that be so?
Yeah, would that be so? So it's a perfect segue to get into the mask conversation, because talk about two groups of people talking past each other. I mean, Jerry, so let's bring some sensibility to it. So we've got one group of people who are saying, look, we know how this virus works, and medical professionals are telling us that we can limit the spread of the disease and we can get out more if we wear a mask. And then we have another sector of society who's saying, look, this is just a symbol of government overreach. This is someone trying to tell me what to do with myself. This is another symbol of the fact that I, as a working class person, have been kept down in America. And so I'm just not going to do it. So how do we possibly see past, first of all, have I laid out the conflict?
Yes.
Well, Jerry, how do you see us possibly talking enough to get past it?
Well, we have to distinguish between the symbol and the reality. One is a prudential question. Do masks help, you know, prevent spread? And it's not a zero or 100%. It's not a they don't matter at all, or it's not a they matter perfectly and you can go, you know, you can go swimming in bat soup and you'll be okay so long as you wear a mask. It's not like that. It's about percentages. Best analysis I've seen is that it cuts spread by about 70%. That's a lot. You know, that really makes a difference. But people aren't talking about that because God has wired us for faces, right? I mean, even before there's humanity, there's the face of the firmament, there's the face of the deep, there's the face of the ground. God breathes breath into the face of Adam, into the nostrils of Adam. Cain's face falls. We need faces. We're wired for faces. So if someone tells you to cover your face up, we're going to feel that as more than just a health precaution. And if somebody uncovers their face, see, there's all these emotional and spiritual levels. And we're talking at that level rather than just making a kind of a prudential decision, which is, hey, well, this can I love my neighbor by wearing a mask? Does it help me love my neighbor by wearing a mask when I'm in a crowd? I think yes. It does, and so I wear one. I don't care about government edicts. You know, I don't really care so much what the government says. I think it's a sensible thing to do. Do I wear a mask when I go bike riding on the trail? No, because there's not a lot of social contact. Do I wear a mask when I'm in Costco? Yes, I wear a mask when I'm in Costco. Or do I wear a mask in church? Yes, I wear a mask in church. I don't wear a mask when I mow my lawn. Can we get to wisdom instead of everything being this mask wearing? Jesus says hypocrites, which is literally hypocrites, people, they're mask wearers. In ancient Greek plays, people wore masks. Mm-hmm. Jesus grew up near Sepphoris, where they had a place for plays. They had a theater there. So Jesus was aware of theater and mask. And I think when Jesus says someone's a hypocrite, he's saying more than they're not following the standards. He's saying they're part of a play. So we're all part of a play in the do wear a mask or don't wear a mask. Am I a good little citizen who listens to the science? That's one mask. Or am I a rugged individualist who isn't going to be told what to do? That's another mask. Forget the play. Just think about love of God and love of neighbor, and then prudentially apply that with the idea that you're supposed to love God and you're supposed to love your neighbor and even love yourself, and then make that your decision-making criterion rather than a statement about who you are.
Very good. That's
I think that's so good, Jerry. Now, I've thought about this. I think, John, you and I were talking about this yesterday, because it is a sensitive issue, and none of us are happy about wearing masks. I mean, when you go out to, you know, I was at Woolies a couple of days ago, and I was having a nice conversation with somebody, except they couldn't tell that I was laughing because, you know, it was loud in there, and they couldn't see my mouth. And so it really does mess up communication. It's not warm. It makes you feel very isolated. And so I get all of that. But I think that maybe setting also has something to do with it. If we understood the setting better, maybe if we understood more of what was going into it. And I say this because if I was laying on a table waiting to go into the OR and the surgeon came in with a mask on, I would not see it as him being impersonal or him being authoritarian or anything like that. I would recognize, because of the setting, why he was wearing it.
Yes, and you could see it as being professional. Right.
Yes.
You could even see it
and
as
consider
love.
It.
Yes. I wouldn't want to see a surgeon come in without a mask. So we're in a situation that's a little bit like that surgery situation. We're in a pandemic. I don't want to exaggerate it, nor do I want to under exaggerate it. Pretty big. 100,000 people are dead. That looks to me like that's about, you know, four or five times your standard flu, and it's not done yet. Then again, it wasn't the zombie apocalypse of, you know, 20 million Americans dead or whatever that some of the experts were talking about. And that's part of the problem, because sometimes experts exaggerate, then sometimes we respond. We talked about the boy who cried wolf, right? The boy cries wolf, and the boy gets hurt, but the whole village gets hurt because actually there might be a wolf and nobody listens and the flock gets eaten. So this is one of these situations where we can't hear one another and we don't have an honest process for weighing things.
All right, Jer. So the president says via tweet, which is about 1/800th of his output over the last 7 days, which is mosques, churches, synagogues are essential. So, you know, tear down the patriarchy and everybody in church go back. How much should churchgoers look at being a church as quote unquote essential?
Well, if they're not essential, they shouldn't open up again. If a church isn't essential, it shouldn't have been there in the first place. It was never designed to be a hobby or a club. It was always designed to be something that is absolutely necessary or something that basically is a distraction. And a lot of churches won't open up again, probably. And that won't just be because of the COVID. That will be because of things that have been happening over, say, a 20 or 30 year period. By the way, I can't help but notice that we asked for a Pentecost and then we got a power surge. But we couldn't hear each other. So I guess it couldn't be a Pentecost thing. Anyway, so does that mean we should go back to church no matter what the government says?
Yeah.
I don't think so. There's a lot of Christian material about this. Christians have been thinking about this for a long time. And the general Christian consensus is that you obey the government, except when the government orders you to disobey God. But you don't just automatically disobey the government. You reason with them. You appeal to other authorities. In other words, you try to work it out. You don't put out a video where you try to go viral where everyone's going to meet this Sunday. Paul appealed to Caesar. He had situations over and over again when the temple authorities said, don't preach the gospel. What did Peter say? He didn't just rabble-rouse and give a speech. We're going to do it anyway. He reasoned with them. He talked to them. So the historic Christian standard is you obey the state unless the state orders you to disobey God, but you exhaust reason and legal remedies first before you disobey. You don't just go right to rabble-rousy, we're going to do whatever whatever we think we should do. You try to turn down social tension rather than try to turn up social tension. And then you do, in the end, if you've gone to the courts and you've appealed whatever to the Justice Department and they still command you not to do something God says to do, then you disobey, you count the cost, you disobey, and you pay the price.
All right, Jerry. So that type of distinction, that type of nuance is exactly what we are proving ourselves incapable of. And I think that's the problem. I just think that people are reacting in an emotional way without really stepping back and saying, no, wait, there are some areas here that require wisdom as we approach them.
Yes. And, the Christian tradition talks about something called prudence. Christianity is not just a matter of zeal. Although zeal matters, it's not zeal, but not after knowledge. It's zeal with knowledge. So these are prudence questions. I mean, look, the early church knew that if they were a rabble-rousy group, Rome would just come in and kill them all. They didn't want that. They wanted to be known as good citizens. So they went the extra mile. Literally, Jesus said, go the extra mile, carry the pack an extra mile. By the way, that's all political stuff. Carrying the pack is a Roman soldier grabbing a Jew off the street and saying, carry my pack. Under Roman law, I can force you to carry my pack. And what does Jesus say? Carry it 2 miles. So that's going beyond what the law requires to show that Jesus's followers are not revolutionaries. They're revolutionary, but they're not revolutionaries. Yeah. And we ought to be the same way.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so Jer, as the non-essential will slip away, what about you personally and your church? Will you be headed back anytime soon?
We were there last week. At St. Peter's, and there was social distancing, and people wore masks, and Father Jay talked about that. And Father Jay asked me if I would preach this Sunday, Pentecost, and I plan to be there preaching. And I will have a mask on when I'm near people, but when I'm up at the front of the church, away from people, I won't wear a mask because they'll be 20, 30 feet away, so that's reasonable. So we'll be prudential. Not everyone's coming back. So look, most mainline churches are so empty. They've got social distancing automatically. I'm sorry to say,
right.
It's social distancing every week, and it has been for 10 years. So a lot of them can come back, but Father Jay's taking precautions, but he's also seen the real cost, the spiritual and social cost of a complete shutdown. So he's using prudence, and I'm proud of him for that.
Excellent.
Terrific. That's Jerry Boyer, editor of Town Hall Finance, and his monthly slot on our show. Jerry, can't tell you how much we appreciate it. We always gain so much, not just from our conversations, but from your consistent, good, wise writing. Thank you.
Thank you. And God bless you both.
My pleasure.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Town Hall Finance, always worth a listen. Find out more about Jerry, of course, online and on Facebook. He posts regularly.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.